Welcome to the podcast of Focus 580, featuring interviews with newsmakers and experts on international affairs and daily life, hosted by David Inge at WILL Radio, Urbana, Illinois. Please support this service by becoming a member and visit us on the web at will.uiuc.edu.
This is Focus 580, our morning talk program. It's the second hour of the show. My name is David Inge. Glad to have you with us. The producers for the program, Harriet Williamson and Martha Deal, and Jason Croft is at the controls. In this part of Focus 580, we'll be talking about Sri Lanka, the island nation that is located off the southern tip of India. For almost 20 years, going back to the mid-1980s, Sri Lanka was torn by violence between the majority Sinhalese people and the minority Tamils. It's estimated that more than 60,000 people were killed as a result of this fighting. Back in 2002, there was a ceasefire, but peace talks that have been held since then have made little progress, and late last year there was a return to violence, which led many people to be concerned that things could indeed get worse again and as bad perhaps as they had been going back now a couple of decades. We'll talk a little bit this morning about Sri Lanka, about this conflict, about the potential for a peaceful resolution in this part of the show. And our guest is Chandra De Silva. He is currently the Dean of the Faculty of Arts and Letters at Old Dominion University in Norfolk, Virginia. Before that, between 1991 and 1998, he chaired the Department of History at Indiana State University in Terre Haute. He's also taught at University of Ceylon and was a visiting professor of history and Asian studies at Bowdoin College in Maine. He also was the first president of the American Institute for Sri Lankan Studies and has written about Sri Lanka, its history, its politics, and has been following them for some time now. And he's been good enough to spend some time with us this morning talking on the phone. Questions are certainly welcome. 333-9455 is the number here in Champaign-Urbana. We also have a toll-free line that is good anywhere that you can hear us, and that is 800-222-9455, 333-9455 here in Champaign-Urbana, and toll-free, 800-222-9455. Professor De Silva, hello.
Hello.
Thank you for talking with us.
Oh, it's a pleasure.
We certainly appreciate it. Let's start out by talking, giving people just some very basic information about Sri Lanka, because I expect that probably there are a lot of people who won't know very much about it. What's good for people to start off knowing?
Well, I will start with very basic information. It's a small country, and as you said, it's an island off the Indian Ocean. The population is about 20 million, and it's a very diverse. The population is very diverse, with majority Sinhalese ethnically and minority Tamils, but also a fairly large group of people who think of themselves as Moors or Muslims. In terms of religion, also there's great diversity, with Buddhists being a majority, but there's also a large number of Hindus, many Muslims, and all varieties of Christians. Do you want me to go on?
Well, just So rather than interrupt you with a question, I will say yes. Go on.
Okay. And one of the things that has characterized Sri Lanka is that the peoples in the country have had a long history and many things in common, so that actually, I think an outsider going to Sri Lanka will not be able to make out many of the differences between the different groups unless you actually look at cultural markers. The point I'm trying to make is that physically people look very much alike. Or in other words, the diversity within each group is greater than the diversity across groups when you look at appearances. It's also, I think it's important also to realize that Sri Lanka has been a democratic country, democratic in the sense that there have been elections and changes in government from the time that Sri Lanka became independent from British colonial rule in 1948. Of course, as you know, in third world countries, democracy is not perfect. There are always flaws in the democratic setup. including questions relating to press freedom, to freedom to campaign for political power, and so on. But by and large, there have been an amazing number of changes in power in the central government through the democratic process. And for a country which is economically not one of the most developed, because if you look at the per capita income, normally the estimate is about $600 per capita. And for countries of that at that level of economic development, the persistence of democracy is something you really need to be happy about.
Mm-hmm.
On the other hand, as you mentioned, in the last 20 years, there has been armed conflict between the government of the country and a group of rebels who are Tamils, who are asking for a separate state in the north and east of Sri Lanka.
Perhaps we can talk a little bit more about that conflict and how it's developed. And as you say, it is a nation where there is diversity, mm-hmm. but we do have the two main groups. The largest group of people are the Sinhalese, who are Buddhist.
Right.
And then the next group would be the Tamils. So they're Hindu. And the Tamils
they are largely Hindu, but there's a significant Christian minority among the Tamils. Mm. If there are, all, of course, different interpretations on how the conflict arose, but by and large, I think it would be fair to say that Tamils participated in the democratic process from the time of independence in 1948 until the 1970s and the early 1980s. And the major leaders of the Tamil groups felt that they did not get a fair share of the rewards, that they were discriminated against. And after a while, the people who participated in the democratic process were sidelined by the rise of more violent groups starting in the 1970s and culminating in the 1980s.
Do you think that the claims that some Tamils have made that they were discriminated against by the Sinhalese majority, do you think that those assertions are fair? Were indeed they discriminated against?
In a number of respects, they were discriminated against. And let me give you a couple of examples. When the British left Sri Lanka, there was a question about what the language, the official language of the country ought to be. And many people suggested that both Sinhala and Tamil, the languages of the two groups, should be recognized as official languages. On the other hand, the majority Sinhalese political parties in the 1950s decided that Sinhala alone would be the national language, which for a time shut out a lot of Tamils from obtaining jobs in the government after being educated in their own language. Now, it is true that education remained in the two languages, and there was no overt discrimination in terms of saying that a Tamil could not get into the government service. On the other hand, when the language of government is not your own, then it is more difficult to get into positions in the government. And this became really important early on, because Sri Lanka did not have a developed private sector, and government positions were the positions that were available in terms of employment for the educated people. So that's one example.
Mm-hmm.
There were other areas in which Tamils claimed discrimination in the distribution of investment, in terms of educational opportunities, and in the whole question of sharing power. So to some extent, I think there was a case that Tamils had that they were not given the same treatment as the Sinhalese. From the Sinhalese point of view, they argued that under colonial rule, minorities had been favored, and all that the governments were doing was to return to some kind of equity. So we have, therefore, two very different perceptions of justice in Sri Lanka. Am I being clear here?
Yes. Thank you. We have there is one Tamil group that now we have gotten used to hearing about that I'm sure people will say, Yes, they heard of. And that is the Liberation Tigers of Tamil Eelam, more commonly known as the Tamil Tigers, organized in the mid-70s. Now, there have been other sort of nationalist Tamil groups. The Tigers have come to dominate, and I suppose there are some people who would argue that that either was good or bad, particularly some people might say bad because they have been responsible for violence, like, for example, the assassination of Rajiv Gandhi in 1991.
Right.
In what way do you think that perhaps the conflict was shaped by or fueled by the ascendance of the Tamil Tigers?
I think before we go there, we need to make clear that there are different groups of Tamils in Sri Lanka. There are Tamils in the north and the east who had been in Sri Lanka for a very, very long time. Mm-hmm. And there are Tamils in the central part of the island who were brought by the British to work in plantations. And up to very recent times, they have had very different political aspirations. It's the people in the north and the east who were talking about a separate state or at least autonomy. The people in the central part of the island were actually in the middle of an area which was inhabited largely by the majority Sinhalese, and their aspirations were more economic. So up to today, the political organization of these two groups has been different. Now, if you're talking simply of the Tamils of the north and the east, they had political leaders who worked in the democratic system, as I said earlier. But in the 1970s, there were a number of groups that began to think that the democratic process would not work, that they had worked with the democratic process for a long time, that they had not really got anything much out of it, and that violence was the way. And the Tigers were one of those groups. But during the 1970s and in the 1980s, the Tigers were able to eliminate the other groups. And in fact, in those days, the Tigers actually, their conflict was more with the other groups as a battle for dominance than with the government of Sri Lanka. But by the 1980s, they were clearly in control.
Our guest in this part of Focus 580, let me introduce again. We're talking with Chandra Da Silva. He's professor of history at Old Dominion University, and that is in Virginia, in Norfolk, Virginia. And as a scholar who has followed for a long time now political developments in Sri Lanka, and that's what we're talking about in this part of the show. Questions are welcome. 333-9455 is the Champaign-Urbana number. We do also have a toll-free line, and that is good anywhere that you can hear us, and that is 800-222-9455. And locally here in Champaign-Urbana, 333-9455. Well, to what extent then do differences among Tamils about what it is that they're interested in complicate matters? I mean, does that make the larger kind of negotiation that seems to be going on between the Sinhalese and the Tamils more complicated if there are various Tamil groups that have different sort of objectives?
Well, it certainly does, because part of the issue, for example, one of the things that we might note right now is that coincidentally, yesterday and today, the Tamil Tigers are talking to the government of Sri Lanka about peace in Geneva. Now, one of the issues that has arisen in the talks is whether the Tamil Tigers are recognized as the only representative of the Tamils, because when they negotiated a ceasefire 4 years ago on the 22nd of February 2002, the government agreed at that time to demilitarize, to sort of disarm all the other Tamil groups in order to deal with the Tamil Tigers as the representatives of these Tamils. In yesterday's negotiations, for example, the Tamil Tigers said that the government had not done this and that that was one of the first steps necessary in order to secure peace and to go forward with an agreement. So it's an issue in terms of who represents the Tamils who live in the north and the east. But there are also groups of Tamils who live among the Sinhalese as a minority in other parts of Sri Lanka. And they are very apprehensive about this civil war because, as you might imagine, they are in the middle of a community that feels threatened by this revolt.
Mm-hmm. Do the Tigers, are they still interested in pursuing an independent Tamil state in the northern part of Sri Lanka?
This is not clear. In the negotiations that followed the ceasefire in 2002, there was some give and take on this, and there were some statements made that they were willing to negotiate some kind of confederal agreement where the Tamil state, the envisaged Tamil state in the north and the east, would have a great deal of power, but might come under an umbrella of a unified Sri Lanka. On the other hand, many of the Sinhalese politicians are very suspicious and do not quite believe this, and think that any agreement would be a step towards a totally separate state. So what one of the things that's lacking is trust on both sides. The Tiger leaders do not trust the Sinhalese-led government, the Sinhalese-dominated government, and the government doesn't really trust the rebel leadership.
We have a caller to bring into the conversation. Let's do that. And someone listening this morning in Urbana, where we are. This is line number one. Hello.
Yeah, I just wanted to briefly ask a question. Two questions, really. One is that I believe I heard that it's the Tamil struggle has generated the most suicide bombers of any other conflict, and I wanted to see if that was true. And then two, a more minor question. I just happened to have picked up a DVD, a movie entitled in English, at least, The Terrorist, by just yesterday. And I don't know if you have happened to see it. It's directed by Santosh Sivan, I believe it is. And it was produced in 1999.
Mm-hmm.
And I don't know if you saw it, but I haven't seen it yet. I was wondering if what you thought of it, if it was biased or whatever. And I'll hang up and listen. Thank you.
Okay.
Actually, I have not seen that particular DVD. But going back to the question of the Tigers, they have been one of the most successful groups of people who organize suicide bombing. I'm not sure whether they have had more suicide bombers than anyone because of what has happened in Iraq in the last year. There have been a lot of suicide bombs in Iraq. But until that time, they were preeminently the leaders in that area. They, apart from some of the well-known people who were killed by suicide bombers, including the Prime Minister of India, Rajiv Gandhi, and the president of Sri Lanka, Ranasinghe Premadasa. There were a number of ministers and leaders who were killed by suicide bombers sent by the Tamil Tigers.
I think it makes it offers an interesting case. I know scholars have looked at it because it seems that we often seem to want to associate religion, want to make religious religion a motivating factor for suicide terrorism. And here is a case where, although there is this religious divide between the majority Sinhalese who are Buddhist and the Tamils who are mostly Hindu. Mm-hmm. The fact of the matter is that this is not not about religion. This is, if anything, it's nationalism that has motivated this. And I think some scholars have argued, in fact, a lot of suicide terrorism is indeed, it really is, at bottom line, it is about nationalism and not about, certainly not about religion.
I would agree. I think both with the general comment that a lot of suicide bombing is about nationalism and not about religion, and with this particular case, because the conflict is not seen as a Buddhist versus Hindu conflict. Having said that, there are rituals associated with the training of suicide bombers, and the idea that once you sacrifice your life, that you would somehow occupy a special place is there in the case of, in the case of many of these organizations. And what I have read about Tamil Tiger operations makes me conclude that that's the case with them too. Because there is, how would you motivate somebody to sacrifice his or her life? You would have to, first of all, convince that person of the justice of the cause, but also provide some reassurance that you would be held, you and your family would be held in high regard for the act that was done, which is now being, which would be then interpreted as being a very noble act, however the outsiders may see it. So I think there's a ritual aspect of it. I don't know whether that is necessarily a religious aspect.
Mm-hmm. Is there some way in which, and I guess I would expect that the answer to the question would be yes, some way in which India has involved itself in this conflict and perhaps not for the better?
Well, India was involved in the conflict back in the 1980s when one of the things that listeners should know is that while the Tamils are a minority in Sri Lanka, across the sea in India there is a very large number of Tamils who actually have a state within India which is called Tamil Nadu. Now, when this conflict broke out, there was a great deal of sympathy in the Indian state of Tamil Nadu about the rights of the Tamils in Sri Lanka. And the Indian government was very concerned. And this eventually led to the sending of an Indian peacekeeping force to Sri Lanka. However, the Indian peacekeeping force fell out with the Tamil Tigers. And having lost about 1,000 soldiers in a guerrilla war, eventually the Indians withdrew. And this was 15 years ago. Since that time, the Indians have tried to help in a diplomatic sense, but because of the earlier conflict, the conflict between the Tigers and the Indian Army, and the subsequent assassination of Rajiv Gandhi, the Tigers have been very suspicious of Indian governments. So they have not been able to actually become a mediating force.
You were talking a little bit earlier about, we talked about the diversity of the population of Sri Lanka, and about the fact that there are these two major groups that there are certainly some differences, but you seem to be suggesting that really, if you looked at it in a rational way, you would have to say that the people of Sri Lanka have much more in common than they do that divides them.
Absolutely. Because I think both, I mean, all the people in Sri Lanka have shared a common culture for a very long period of time. And although we are talking about two different languages, because people have lived together for a long time, there is a lot of commonality, not only in vocabulary, but even in cultural practices. For example, if you look at what's celebrated as New Year in Sri Lanka, both the Sinhalese and the Tamils celebrate their New Year in April. And this is peculiar to Sri Lanka. It's not celebrated by Tamils in other parts of the world, including India. It's one of the things that's common. There are many commonalities in terms of food, in terms of customs. And I know that before the conflict arose, people who were Buddhists quite often frequented Hindu temples. And there were up to a point a limited number of marriages across the ethnic divide. Now that has declined. And finally, maybe I should mention that English provided a bridge.
The English language between Tamil speakers and
right.
and Sinhalese, because it was one thing that they could have in common and could use to
exactly.
communicate with one another.
Mm. Yes. This is part of the British legacy. The educated elite in Sri Lanka in the 50s and the 60s, they spoke English. And so they could communicate very easily across. Now, this became less so when education came to be in the local languages, because most Sinhalese do not speak Tamil, and a lot of Tamils don't speak Sinhala. Mm-hmm.
We are just a bit past our midpoint here. I'd just like to introduce again our guest for this hour of Focus 580. We are talking with Chandra De Silva. He is Dean of the Faculty of Arts and Letters at Old Dominion University in Norfolk, Virginia. He also, before that, for 7 years, chaired the Department of History at Indiana State University in Terre Haute. And he also was the first president of the American Institute for Sri Lankan Studies and has written extensively on contemporary Sri Lanka politics, culture. Questions welcome, 333-9455 here in Champaign-Urbana, toll-free 800-222-9455. Are there particular institutions you think in Sri Lanka that are positioned to, in a sense, to bring people together to work on building commonalities and perhaps encourage people to think perhaps not so much in terms of identities as, for example, Sinhalese and Tamil, to think of themselves as Sri Lankan first and the others perhaps second?
There are some. It's very hard being a moderate in Sri Lanka. It's hard to draw to try to build bridges when there is armed conflict. But there are a number of social service organizations which operate both in the northern Tamil areas and in the south. The both communities have Christian groups, and in fact, the Catholic Church is quite prominent in both communities. And historically, that has helped a little bit. On the other hand, you have now had a conflict for 20 years. And especially in the north and the east, among the minority Tamils, people have grown up, and the only Sinhalese they have seen are people belonging to the Sri Lankan armed forces. And that does not really help. So what I'm saying is, there are some institutions, but continuing conflict makes it very difficult. There was, I think, a major opportunity when the tsunami struck Sri Lanka at the end of last year, when actually a large number of people of both communities went to the areas that were affected, worked together, worked to help the people who were affected. Some of you may recall that something like over 35,000 people died in Sri Lanka because of the tsunami. Mm-hmm. Over a million were lost their houses or had their houses damaged. So the calamity brought people together, and people worked together for a short time. And then when there came questions about how to distribute money for reconstruction, the government and the Tigers could not agree. And once again, certainly the Tamils in the north didn't get direct assistance because of squabbling over the mechanism. And I'm sure that worsened the situation.
Let's talk with another person who is here listening, someone who is in Indiana on our toll-free line, line number 4. Hello.
Hello. I was wondering if there's a money trail. I presume the government has money for its own forces, but the Tamil rebels, do they have money from their, in a sense, their agriculture or what? I mean, where does that money come from to purchase the guns and the bullets and that sort of thing? Are there any foreign countries getting involved, trying to make things go one way or the other, other than the general situation you talked about, India sending in peacekeepers? I was just wondering about that mm-hmm. aspect of the problem. Thank you.
This is a very good question. One of the major sources of support of the Tamil Tigers is the expatriate Tamil community. There are large numbers of Tamils who live in Canada, in England, and in Australia, a few in the United States. And many of them send money to Sri Lanka to help the Tiger movement. So that's one of the sources of funding. A second source of funding is the fact that the rebels actually occupy a certain amount of territory in Sri Lanka. Within that area, they impose taxes. When goods come into that area from outside, once again, they impose tariffs. And so they raise money within Sri Lanka itself. They also have some commercial enterprises. And it's known that they have small naval vessels. They have some business enterprises. So there is a cash flow that comes in because war is expensive.
All right. Other questions are welcome. 333-9455, toll-free 800-222-9455. You mentioned the fact, we talked a little bit about the fact that there is this record of fighting that does go back to, say, about the mid-80s. Mm-hmm. About 20 years, and that there was a ceasefire, though, that happened in 2002, mm-hmm. and that there have been peace talks that have happened off and on that haven't really gone anywhere. And as you mentioned, in fact, right now, the two sides are meeting in Geneva, and I don't think anybody's thinking that anything great is going to change, at least things aren't going to turn around right away, that they still seem to be kind of deadlocked as they have been. What happened back in 2002 that made it possible for, at least at that time, for the two sides to agree to a ceasefire?
In the late 1990s, I think both sides thought that they could actually win the war through military means, and there was a lot of open fighting, and both sides lost a lot of men and material. And by 2001, it was clear that neither side could actually win a military victory. And just to go back to question asked by one of the person who spoke last. The Sri Lankan government finances its military purchases by itself, and they were running out of money as well. So both sides eventually decided in 2001 to try to work together, and there was a cessation of hostilities in December 2001, which was cemented by a ceasefire agreement in February 2002. And at that time, I was a lot more hopeful about an agreement, because the ceasefire agreement was followed by meetings in September 2002 in Thailand, where the two sides agreed to open up roads, to talk about rehabilitation, set up committees, and then started talking about the final possible political solution. But eventually, by the next year, there was not very much progress, and the Tigers withdrew from the talks by March, April 2003. Part of the reason was, it is speculated that part of the reason was that they feared that international pressure would, in the wake of September 11th, would actually help the Sri Lankan government, because the Tigers were listed as a terrorist organization. And eventually they withdrew from the whole peace process. And therefore, for about 2 years, for 3 years actually, almost 3 years, there has been no meeting between the two sides. In the middle of this, in between the time that the ceasefire was signed and the current negotiations, there was a change in the government in Sri Lanka. The government that the political party that signed the ceasefire is no longer in power in Sri Lanka, and therefore their opponents who have come in are now picking holes in the ceasefire and saying that agreement was not really fair by the government of Sri Lanka. So I think the two sides are further away. They are more further apart than ever today.
Mm-hmm. So, and it sounds as if it's certainly not, it doesn't help that, at least certainly within the Tamil side, there are different people who perhaps have different objectives. And that it sounds, though, also as if on the side of the government, that there may also be some divisions in terms of the kind of policies that people think ought to be implemented.
Correct. Because there was a presidential election in 2000, at the end of last year, in November 2005. And one of the major issues in the presidential election was whether the ceasefire with the Tamil Tigers was a good one. And the people who criticized the ceasefire, the person who criticized the ceasefire, won the presidential election and became president. So he is the person who is now negotiating with the Tamil Tigers. His ministers are negotiating with the Tamil Tigers. On the other hand, if you look at the Tamil Tigers, in 2004, there was a dissident movement within the Tamil Tigers. And the dissidents left the Tiger movement, and they are another paramilitary force in Sri Lanka. So the Tamil Tigers also have dissidents. The Sri Lankan government faces a political opposition. And so the whole issue is pretty complicated.
We have about 10, 12 minutes left in this part of Focus 580, and I would like to introduce again our guest, Chandra Da Silva. He is Dean of the Faculty of Arts and Letters at Old Dominion University in Norfolk, Virginia. He was the first president of the American Institute for Sri Lankan Studies. He's written extensively on many aspects of contemporary Sri Lanka. And questions are welcome, 333-9455. Toll free 800-222-9455. We have a question that is coming in actually from someone off the air that I think is interesting, and would be interested in hearing you speak as an historian about whether the what sort of role that history and doing history can play either in a conflict like this, either in creating conflict or in helping to resolve the conflict?
Oh, that's a very interesting question. And I think it can work both ways. In fact, part of the conflict is based on different perceptions of the past. Because, for example, the Tamils who are rebelling think of themselves not so much as a minority, but as a group that had a different political existence in Sri Lanka for a very, very long time. So if you take that point of view, then they are not asking. What they would say is that they are not asking for rights as a minority, but they are asking for rights as a nation. On the other hand, the Sinhalese look at Sri Lanka and say, this has been a Sinhalese country, a Sinhalese majority country, a Sinhalese dominated country, and maybe even a totally Sinhalese country for a very long time. The Sinhala people can trace back their history through chronicles for a very long time, maybe more than 2,000 years. So this perception does influence the attitudes people take. And secondly, each side has taken what it wants from the past in order to bolster its claims and to point out how bad the other side has been. So history can be a force that actually worsens conflict. On the other hand, I think it's possible to use history in order to bring people together as well, as I was trying to explain. The people in Sri Lanka also have many commonalities. They have a common history. They have a history also of working together, because if you look at the long past, the past, there are many times when people work together against invaders from outside, for example, including the European colonial powers. So history is a two-edged weapon.
Mm-hmm.
And it depends on what you can use and what you want to use it for.
Let's talk with someone else in Urbana on our line number one. Hello.
Yes, Professor Da Silva, could you give us a brief thumbnail history of Ceylon during the Second World War, its connection in its liberation from British imperialism, to the struggle on the Indian subcontinent and Gandhi, and the radical left party's roles? I believe, and there were two main factions. I know the Trotskyists were rather strong in the 50s and up through 62, and I won't rejoin. There's not enough time, but thank you very much.
Yeah, you're absolutely right. Well, Ceylon, as it was known, and Sri Lanka, as it is known today, was important in the Second World War. It was the headquarters of the Southeast Asia Command. And in fact, the university that became the University of Ceylon was actually the headquarters of Lord Mountbatten, who was in charge of that area. Ceylon was bombed by Japanese bombers early on in 1942. And then it became the headquarters through which the liberation of Burma by the British was organized. Now, during this time, as you correctly point out, there was a nationalist movement against the British. However, the nationalist movement against the British, by and large, was very different from that of India. While in India, Gandhi roused or organized the masses and went and led a mass movement, largely, the Sri Lankan politicians were conservative, they were English educated, and they worked with the British. And the reason why Sri Lanka or Ceylon got independence in 1948 was largely because the British gave independence to India, and the politicians in Sri Lanka could argue that we who have worked with the British should not be penalized because we did not agitate for independence in the same way as the Indians. You're absolutely right that there was also another, there was a fairly strong left-wing movement at this time, which was led by a Trotskyite party. And the Trotskyites were very strong. There was a Communist Party and a Trotskyite Party. The Communist Party was always weaker than the Trotskyites. The Trotskyites were one of the major opposition parties starting in the 1940s. They got into governments in the 1950s, but eventually they got caught in this division between Sinhalese and Tamils and had to take sides and eventually lost their leftist credentials by the mid-1960s. They are no longer a force today.
We're coming down here to the point where we have maybe 3-4 minutes left. I guess I find myself wondering whether you think it's possible to imagine a kind of solution here that would grant enough autonomy to some kind of a Tamil region in the north, enough autonomy to satisfy them, while at the same time satisfying Sinhalese who don't like the idea of dividing the nation and who have the idea that the goal is some sort of unitary state. Is there, do you think it's possible for there to be some kind of middle ground that in a sense gives everyone a little bit of what they want, and perhaps not giving everyone all that they want?
I think that's the only solution. Now, there may be people who say you need a unitary state, but I think that differences have grown to be so great that it is very difficult now to impose a unitary state in Sri Lanka. The fact is that in reality, you have a group of people who control certain parts of the country. And the only way to get them back into the political process is to negotiate a deal where people are able to govern themselves in the areas in which they live. The obstacle to this is the lack of trust. And I think that the negotiations in Geneva, which I do not expect to yield any results except hopefully for an agreement to talk again, that if people keep on talking and develop mechanisms by which the lives of the ordinary people become better through agreements, then I think eventually we can work towards a political process. Right now what's happening is that you're having a lot of rhetoric and people have entrenched positions and they're not really talking about solutions.
How has this conflict affected the willingness of people to follow through on promises to provide money to help the continued recovery from the tsunami? Does that get in the way from that, and then does that also have some sort of larger implication in the conflict and in the ability to try to move towards some resolution?
Well, you're absolutely right, because a lot of the aid that was promised for the tsunami is held up pending a political settlement. So that's the carrot that the major nations, including the United States, the European Union, and Japan, are holding out. What they're saying is, unless we have some progress towards a political settlement, it would be very difficult to release the money. And this money is in the region of something close to $3 billion. The money is held up because there is no political settlement, and for good reason, because these donor countries want to ensure that all the groups benefit from the money and that the money is not channeled to one group or the other. The difficulty in Sri Lanka is that the tigers say that some of the money should be directly channeled to them. The government doesn't want that, thinking that the tigers will use that to buy arms. The government says the money should be channeled through them, but the Tigers don't trust them to distribute the money equitably. And we are stuck at the moment.
Mm-hmm. Well, we are going to have to stop there, I think, because we've come to the end of the time. Professor De Silva, we want to thank you very much for giving us some of your time and talking with us.
It was a pleasure.